Inflation is headed in the right direction, yes, but at what cost? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 31st of March. Good to have you with us. This is one of those days when the big story you're probably hearing about pretty much everywhere else is not what we're going to talk about, because there is plenty going on in this economy to sort out, including the latest inflation report from the Commerce Department. To help us make sense of it all, we've got Lynette Lopez at Business Insider on the line, along with Jordan Holman from The New York Times, who's actually at Marketplace HQ today. Welcome back, you two.
Hi.
All right, let's start with that inflation report. The PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, was up 0.3% in February from the prior month and running at 5% inflation from a year ago. Lynette, what's your takeaway?
Well, it is one of the lowest reads we've had since 2021. So it shows us that the Fed, you know, hiking interest rates, it seems to be slowing the economy. Some of the maybe jolts that we've had in the job market, some of the firings are slowing down the economy, that kind of stuff. That's what we want to see. The question is, how much of it are we going to see? We had a little scare in our banking sector as a few banks fell over the last couple of weeks. And the question is credit going to tighten up so much? Is the economy going to go so slow that we tip it into a recession, which is, you know, the question we've been asking for a year now.
Right. Also in this report, Jordan, we got some numbers on consumer spending, which adjusted for inflation fell 0.1% in February. That's obviously a big change from January when it was up, you know, 1.5%. What does this tell you about how consumers are faring right now?
I think the same thing with consumer spending is that we've been seeing there hasn't been a straight line to find a trend. So it is a bit uneven. People are saying like, well, maybe though it looked like this in February, we can't say that it will happen in March. And so right now, I think as consumers are trying to still just wait and see if they have a job, be conservative, it is affecting what they're spending on, if they're going to spend on big ticket items. And that's obviously showing up in this consumer spending number. So right now, everyone pretty much expects that the first half of the year is going to be uneven. The big question is, does that unevenness continue in 2023 as we move further into the year?
Yeah. So a lot of uncertainty. Lynette, obviously the Fed is taking all of this in, plus what you mentioned in the banking sector is doing some of the work, I guess, for the Fed in terms of potentially slowing down some economic growth. 5% annual inflation is obviously still too high. So what do you think would need to happen in the month before that next Fed meeting that might make them consider pausing on raising interest rates?
You know, I don't think there's much to make them consider pausing unless the banking sector really starts to ache. But we're seeing the outflows that we've been monitoring, the outflows from the banking system, and they seem to be stabilizing as this kind of psychological panic for some of the customers of these like smaller and regional banks seem to calm down as the Fed is like putting out these little fires. The Fed seems, and the Treasury, both of them seem to think that they can handle each bank on a case by case basis. And if that's the case, then I don't see how, I don't see why the Fed would stop continuing to raise interest rates because its target is 2% inflation. So it's kind of like that, and I don't mean to scare anybody, but if you're watching like a thriller movie or your horror movie, and you know that like the killer is going to come around the corner at some point, like at some point, all of this work that the Fed has done and all this slowing of the banking system and crashing is going to have an effect on the economy. We know it is. It's going to slow it down even more than it is slowed right now. We just don't know how much, and we don't know when it's all going to hit. So, you know, the thriller continues.
So at some point we're going to be startled, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Or we're going to do that, you know, the dance moves and the Michael Jackson video and everything will be all right. I doubt that, but
we got to start practicing.
Yeah, it's a thriller. Start practicing.
Yeah, so we said on the show yesterday that a lot of the data we're getting now has sort of an asterisk because it was gathered pre-bank failures. Jordan, though, I'm wondering just how much you think all this is on the mind of a typical shopper, you know, when they go out to buy groceries or a TV or, as you wrote about this week, maybe a pair of Crocs.
I think it hasn't fully affected how people are shopping. It does feel separate. It's like that's happening in the banking world. I haven't actually seen it show up in my real life. Retailers especially think that way right now, are banking on the fact that shoppers aren't like scared to pull out their wallets because of it. But what might actually happen, where the flow might happen, is if investment on the retailer side slows up, then that could affect what they can start offering or the services they have. And then that in turn will actually be the determining factor of how much shoppers are spending. So it might not start at the shopper level and the pullback happen. It might actually start from the company level, that pullback happening, and then shoppers will change their habits. So it's still a lot of wait and see, but it hasn't fully, we don't know the full extent of how consumers are feeling about what's happening in the banking world.
Before I let you go, Lynette, I just have to ask you about the hearings this week on SVB and banking going forward. The White House is also proposing new rules, or really restoring old rules for mid-sized banks. Where do you see the regulatory response going from here?
I think that the White House is confident that it can do a lot on its own through rulemaking. In Congress, there seems to be an appetite to get some of those rules together too, but it's, you know, lobbyists, something happens in this country, we get scared about it in the banking system, and, you know, we make some new rules and then people forget about it and the lobbyists chop at it a little bit, and, you know, a little bit by bit. So let's see what happens with this regulation. It seems like Congress is interested in doing something now, but let's see what happens when the banks go to work.
Yeah,
because they want to be able to take as much risk as they can. Yeah, I don't put too much stock in regulation of the banking system.
All right. Well, we got to leave it there. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Jordan Holman at The New York Times. Thank you both so much and have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks.
On Wall Street, another up day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To get through the past several weeks, banks have been taking out emergency loans from the Federal Reserve to ensure they can cover withdrawals from customers. As of Wednesday, banks had tapped more than $152 billion from two backstop lending facilities set up by the Fed. That's actually down from $164 billion borrowed during the week before. And it's a sign that the threat of more bank runs may be waning. One of those emergency lending programs is called the discount window. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, banks really try to avoid it.
When we write a check, our banks have to make sure our money is there when it is supposed to be, right? But what if the bank can't move money fast enough for it to be there? Well, they borrow it, usually just for like a day, and usually from other banks. But sometimes
it's other counterparty banks are saying, you're in more trouble than we're comfortable with. You should go see the Fed.
Peter Conti Brown is a professor of financial regulation at Wharton. So back in the olden days, like 1913, when the Fed was created, a bank would go to an actual window at the Fed and get a loan. Problem solved. At least that's how it used to work.
The discount window mostly atrophied from the 1950s until 2008.
During the financial crisis around 2008, of course, all kinds of banks had to use the discount window. But in normal times, the Fed has discouraged them from using it, says Conti Brown. And banks, big ones anyway, haven't used it much. The reason is it just looks bad.
I'm pleased, sir. May I have another? We're a very poor bank and having some trouble.
This image problem is very real. Bill Nelson is chief economist at the Bank Policy Institute and spent 20 years at the Fed. Some years back, a friend of his got a job as a bank treasurer.
When he took his position, he was told if he were to end up borrowing from the discount window. There'd be two phone calls. One would be a call from the president of the New York Fed asking what happened, and the second would be a call from human resources to him telling him to clear out his desk.
In 2008, the Fed tried to set up other ways for banks to borrow, but it didn't solve the stigma problem, says Nelson.
It's a tremendous problem because you could think of the discount window in many instances as a safety valve.
But it's a safety valve that banks aren't comfortable using enough, he says. Silicon Valley Bank could probably have had a softer landing, says Peter Conti Brown, if it had been prepared to use the discount window earlier. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Jordan and I talked earlier about how people are feeling about the economy right now. According to the University of Michigan, consumer sentiment dropped in March for the first time in 4 months. Running a business means adapting to the changing climate. You have to plan for the possibility that spending might slow. And that brings us to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Sonia McMorrin. I'm the owner of Homework, a decor and gift shop in Santa Cruz, California. We opened in 2015, and Santa Cruz at the time was in the middle of a transition. It was moving away from being a sleepy beach town to being a real destination that the tech community in Silicon Valley wanted to live in. And with recent layoffs that have been happening in the tech industry, there is a lot of concern about whether or not the new population here is going to be able to continue supporting Santa Cruz. And I've noticed that there's been a tightening of purse strings. When I started my business, I never considered that I would have to think about what the weather is going to be like. After the fires up in Northern California in 2018 that pushed smoke into the area, it kind of opened my eyes to the idea that here's another thing that I'm going to have to take into consideration when I'm planning out my year. And in August of 2020, Santa Cruz itself suffered one of the biggest wildfires that it had ever had. And I kind of had to start thinking about not just how to run a retail business through a medical pandemic, but also through a climate pandemic. I've really relied on my weather app. So if we know that a big atmospheric river is coming, I know that I need to push on social media the ability for folks to purchase things online and collect them quickly when they're doing other errands, or have us be able to deliver them locally if they are unable to get to us. Santa Cruz is an incredibly resilient community and has relied heavily on local tourism as well as regional tourism. And when we have these weather events, the rest of the world can't get to us. And that makes it really difficult. But when we have these moments of climate disaster, it's our local community that really comes together and really works on making sure that their local mom and pops survive whatever's been thrown at them.
We can't do this series without you, so let us know what's going on in your economy. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
You guys are in the right place.
For what exactly? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 415 points, 1.25% to finish at 33,274. The NASDAQ added 208 points, 1.75% to end at 12,221. The S&P 500 was up 58 points, 1.4% to close at 4,109. For the week, the Dow added 3.2%. The NASDAQ improved 3.4%. The S&P 500 was down. I'm sorry, it was also up 3.5%. Former President Donald Trump, who's expected to be arraigned in New York on Tuesday, has been rallying his supporters on his Truth Social media network. Investors seem to think his legal woes will boost traffic to the site. Digital World Acquisition, a special purpose acquisition company that's set to merge with Truth Social, grew 7.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Oil prices have been climbing this week, with the global price now around $80 a barrel. When we talk about the global price of oil, we're usually referring to something called the Dated Brent benchmark. You might hear it in news reports simply as Brent crude. By some estimates, Dated Brent is used to set the price of two-thirds of the crude oil sold around the world. But the way that benchmark price is determined is about to change, with U.S. oil deposits playing a larger role. Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports.
The Brent benchmark was named after the Brent oil field in the North Sea between Scotland and Norway. But that oil deposit is running dry, as all oil fields eventually do, says Rory Johnston of the Commodity Context Research Service.
This is a normal part of the industry.
So other grades of oil from the same region have been added over the years. Collectively, those grades are known as the BFOET.
Which stands for Brent, Forties, Osberg, Ekofisk, and Troll.
Sounds like a bunch of Harry Potter characters. But now, the fields where those grades of oil are drilled aren't producing as much as before either, says Tracy Shuchart of Hill Tower Resource Advisors.
There's not a lot of expansion there. They're getting older.
So S&P Global Commodity Insights, which publishes the Brent Index, started looking for another grade of crude oil, because the more volume available, the more accurate the price.
They could have added another Norwegian big oil field, but the oil from there didn't fit the profile.
Oil that's not too thick, not too thin, and without too much sulfur, West Texas Intermediate Midland fit the bill and is set to be included in the Brent benchmark. That's a big deal for the U.S., which Yoon Creek of Argus Media says is now the largest oil producer in the world.
What it really underlines is the rise of the U.S. as a oil exporting power.
Keeping in mind that up until 2015, the U.S. had a ban on exporting oil, a lot has changed in just 8 years. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Republicans in Congress are pushing an idea they say could curb the national debt and help solve the labor shortage, require more people who receive certain government benefits to work. Many welfare programs already have some work requirements, from food stamps to temporary assistance for needy families, also known as cash welfare. The goal is to make sure recipients don't become dependent on government handouts. In the latest season of Marketplace's podcast, The Uncertain Hour, Chrissy Clark does a deep dive on the welfare-to-work system. She visited one program for people receiving cash welfare in Milwaukee, a program that, like many, has been outsourced to a for-profit company.
My first visit to a for-profit welfare office was in 2019 in Milwaukee. In a conference room, some parents who'd recently turned to cash welfare were attending a job readiness class. The teacher just asked them to talk about their dreams.
I want to be a nurse, so I'm going to go into the RN program. That's my main goal.
Basically, my dream is to go to college and put the position behind myself where my baby will always have something to fall back on.
These women were here at this class because they're required to be. It's one of the federally mandated work activities they've been assigned to do in order to get a welfare check. This class and the welfare office where it's happening are run by a multi-billion dollar multinational company named Maximus. It and several other for-profit companies have cropped up in the last 30 years to administer and enforce welfare work requirements.
You guys are in the right place.
That's Joe Murphy, former Wall Street consultant, now a VP at Maximus. He helped design this job readiness curriculum. It covers things like job interviews, business casual versus formal business attire. Joe's encouraging the women to dream big, says Maximus can help them get started with the right job.
And all you need is a hand up. You guys are strong and you guys can do almost anything. You just need to be guided in the right direction sometimes. Remember, the goal is self-sufficiency.
All the women here today are poor. Most are Black, living in one of the most segregated cities in America. They listen as Joe, who's white, hands out motivational aphorisms about hard work.
The demon we swallow, I can't remember who said that, the demon we swallow makes us stronger.
Conducting these motivational job readiness classes, assigning required work activities, and getting people on welfare employed, that's what governments pay Joe's company, Maximus, to do. Joe says a private company is better poised to get people jobs than the government because they already have a business mentality.
We look from the perspective of the employer. We look at the employer as a customer.
Joe's colleague Rick Ibarra says Maximus takes welfare recipients who need to fulfill work requirements and pitches them to employers who have jobs to fill, usually pretty low-paying entry-level jobs, customer service, packing and assembly work in warehouses.
High-level talent, you know, accountants and MBAs, we'll be honest, that's not the participant base that we have.
To show me how Maximus can help turn participants into workers, Joe and Rick introduced me to Quanessa Simpson. She'd first applied for welfare in 2018 after her second child was born. She didn't have permanent housing and she didn't have a job.
It was very hard. You know, I didn't have an income to provide for a newborn baby with not working a stable job. So it was kind of like, I need this now, you know?
Quanessa told me the government welfare check she got through Maximus helped a lot. About $650 a month, as long as she could fulfill all her work assignments. One of them, working without pay at a local nonprofit.
I worked in a pantry, the office, cleaning.
Sometimes she was assigned to work there 40 hours a week. If you divide that into her welfare check, she was essentially making about $4 for each hour of required work, way less than minimum wage. Maximus says this kind of labor can give people valuable work experience, like an unpaid internship for being a janitor. And after several months, Quanessa did get an actual paying job as a custodian.
Take the garbage, dust mop floors, pretty simple work, and I'm thankful for.
But the job was part-time, no benefits. It didn't put her family over the poverty line, and she still qualified for food stamps. And according to her resume, she'd already worked as a cleaner before she turned to welfare at Maximus. One job, cleaning a daycare center. Another?
I was cleaning Airbnbs.
How did you find those jobs?
Friend of the family or something like that, you know.
Meaning it's unclear how much Maximus or that unpaid cleaning experience Quanessa was required to do really helped Quanessa land her later custodian job. Quanessa says she's grateful for the interview and resume coaching she got from Maximus, but Maximus got something out of Quanessa, too. We obtained the contracts that private companies like Maximus have with the state of Wisconsin, and we discovered that when someone on welfare gets a job, the company can claim thousands of dollars in special payments from the state if the job lasts more than a month, regardless of whether it gets them over the poverty line or off government assistance. If it lasts 3 months, companies can claim more. Between the money the state paid Maximus to manage Quanessa's welfare case, plus these special rewards they could get for that part-time custodian job she landed, Maximus likely received as much, if not more, in government welfare dollars off Quanessa than Quanessa received in cash assistance. In the last decade, the state of Wisconsin paid Maximus more than $7 million because a few thousand people on welfare got jobs.
Poverty is big business.
Pat D'Alessio is a legal aid attorney in Milwaukee. She's worked with many families on welfare. She says more government money should go directly to families rather than for-profit welfare companies. And she questions how much this welfare-to-work system actually helps.
In general, people aren't getting the opportunity for long-term success. And most people, you know, they can get these low-wage jobs on their own.
The Wisconsin agency that oversees cash welfare told us in a statement that the governor plans to formally evaluate the welfare-to-work program before the next contracts with private welfare agencies start. When I checked back in on Quanessa recently, she was working full-time at a daycare, plus a part-time job at a Dollar Tree. Altogether, she makes less than $4,000 a month. Her family still relies on state health insurance, while she works more than 60 hours a week. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Thank you.
His final note on the way out today, a little preview of something coming next week. My Morning Report colleague David Brancaccio interviewed the new president of the Boston Fed, Susan Collins, who started last summer. She talked about how she views a possible recession.
There are, of course, risks and uncertainties, and it's important to take those very seriously. At the same time, I see a lot of resilience in the economy, and my baseline case is that we bring inflation down without requiring a significant downturn. One of the key risks is a loss of confidence that could actually be self-fulfilling. And again, there are many dimensions in which our economy is proving quite resilient.
You can hear the full interview on Monday's Marketplace Morning Report. We packed a lot in, so no extra context today. Sorry about that. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a great weekend. This is APM.